Okay, welcome to Mythology, Part 3. Today we're going to talk about Greek gods and goddesses. Now, this is a lot of material. We could spend years on this. So let's do this. First, I'll say some general things about Greek deities. And then, for about an hour, I'll go through the main deities. But we can't even do all the main ones. Zeus, Poseidon, Apollo, Aphrodite, Athena, some of them. Then we'll take a 10-minute break, about 2:30, and then after that, we'll talk about a couple in a little more depth, Demeter and Persephone and Dionysus. So there'll be more coherent themes there. In the beginning, we'll run through various deities and say some interesting things, and I'll show you all these slides, but actually I'll skip a lot of slides, so I hope you don't mind that, because we won't be able to get everything in. Well, first, Greek deities in general. One thing people are interested in a lot today is the prehistory of gods and goddesses. You hear a lot today about this. It's not our main topic now, but this is on our minds, as in this bestseller everybody was reading. Were there goddesses who ruled? And was this much better? And then at some time did these bad men take over and suppress that dark secret and all this? Gender wars. This is basically gender wars. In my opinion, it tells a lot about us and our politics that we argue who's more powerful, who came first, and so on. This is a very recent trend. But that's on our minds today. And whenever we talk about this, many people are interested in that. That is, people want goddesses. People are looking for early goddesses to see if there's some pattern of going from female to male. And, of course, this is not neutral. This is very highly charged. That's often put in value terms. It was better in the beginning. They worshipped the earth, fertility, nature, females. And then came men and wars in Iraq and things like that, right? So notice that this is a concept which we should think about. We should think about how we think about that. Why do we put things in that kind of pattern, since it's much more complicated than that? One term useful there is chthonic. Then this is the idea that earlier deities were the earth, related to the earth and fertility, growing, giving birth, therefore more female. Chthonic, C-H-T-H-O-N-I-C, from the Greek word for earth. So this would be also a really hypothesis in the history of religion that you go from earth deities who seem more female to sky deities who are male. Well, we're not going to stress this, but various issues will come up as we go through the deities about males and females and nature and many, many other things, earth and sky and human beings and everything about existence. So I would say myself that it's about existence, it's about nature, and this comes before male and female, that nature even comes first. Nature gives us both male and female, right? Are females nature and men are not nature, right? What kind of assumptions are we using there? So I would say, since it, you know, you hear so much about this and there's always questions about this, that what about this idea that there were female goddesses earlier? Well, maybe, but the evidence is complex, and we'd have to argue about a lot of details that are not clear. This refers to prehistory. And I would say, one, you never have female goddesses without males. Do you ever have women without men or men without women? That if even if you worship the earth and fertility, is there a male? Do you need a male to give birth? Who fertilizes the earth, right? The sky. So you always have sky and earth. And in these ancient beliefs, men could be led to fertility too. Because after all, nature made two. You need two to come together to give birth. The birth involved somehow. That is, some combination. You always have them in some combinations. And why do we argue today which one is more powerful and all? That what we do is we try to use ancient history to say, well, men have been powerful. Men have ruled for so long. If we don't like that, maybe we'll say women should rule or women used to rule. But then this is still saying it's okay to rule. You know, we're talking about who's more powerful. We're fighting these battles, and I'm saying maybe it's not about those kind of battles. You always have a good role for both, but it changes over time. There are always interesting combinations. There's never one without the other. But this kind of talk today shows how we use ancient times and how it's still relevant for these kind of issues, like that bestseller, which I don't really want to name. But and also, a second general point about this, say the early history of nature, religion, or the early deities, is that suppose it's true, okay, it's fine, they worshipped fertility, this would be natural. Religion is about birth and death. We want to explain where we came from and where we go to. That's the first thing people say, right? Well, what do you think happens when you die? You know, if you're talking about religion. So religion is about birth and death. So this would be natural to say they were interested in fertility, life, the life cycle. What is behind life, the endless life cycle of change and birth and death over time? Well, this is not totally utopian, though, to say, well, they worship the earth, oh, it's all great, you know, they're all happy and rosy, and, you know, because fertility for the ancients was ambiguous. If you worship nature, nature gives you life. But nature also gives you death. We saw this before in the creation stories. Whatever is born dies. So something you see here is that fertility deities are also involved with death. They're also deities involved with death. The early mother creators in the early creation stories, like Gaia for the Greeks or Tiamat for the Babylonians from the first two times, these are both benevolent and destructive. That is, nature gives you birth, but nature can send you a flood. So to say they worship nature doesn't mean everything was rosy, utopian, like we often talk about for political reasons. So that would be my little editorial. And basically there are many other things besides this kind of issue of one versus the other. Okay, so let's go to the Greeks. And by the way, it is definitely male-dominated and patriarchal here, which is why there's interesting questions of what came before. But where did the Greeks come from? Remember, the Greeks came into Greece at some point as part of these migrations of the Indo-Europeans, who are a language family, speakers of related languages from India and Persia to most of the people of Europe, and even Anatolia, which is the Turkey Peninsula. So this is lost in prehistory before 2000 BC, maybe long before then. Well, all these people, the Greeks, the ancient Indians who spoke Sanskrit, the ancient Germans, and so forth, they have certain similarities because they had a common origin. And one is a sky god, a male sky god or a storm god. So some of this helps to explain Zeus and the Olympians. Sometimes you see parallels in these other cultures. That is, it entered at some point. And this is why we said before there's some debate. If the Greeks come into Greece at some period, 2000 something, the main god is a sky god, were people worshipping an earth mother before that? That's the issue, which is hard to get at, let's think about how we think about that. Okay. So, with the Greeks, a couple of other general things. We saw the Greek myth of creation, which describes how there were three generations of the ruling deities of the sky. First, sky itself, Uranus, was married to Earth. So sky and Earth ruled, and then came the Titans, the second generation of the ruling gods, and then third came Zeus and the Olympians, who defeat the Titans, who had defeated the ones before them, and the Olympians come to rule. The Olympians are Zeus and his siblings. That's half the Olympians. That's six of them. And the other ones are children of Zeus. Okay? So we're going to talk about the Olympians. Well, the Greeks actually had many more than 12 gods and goddesses. There are many more than 12. We think of 12 Olympians. This is a round number. You know, 12 is kind of like 10. It's just a round number, right? Or seven. You know, the Bible is full of seven. Or, you know, like Troy was for 10 years, you get these round numbers. Well, that is, it's a canon and a fake canon, because at one point they made an altar of the 12 gods in Athens, and this is where they had to list the 12. There were more than 12. So to get to 12, you have to say a couple of others were bumped out and make up that story. But really, there were more than 12. And really, there were thousands and thousands of deities in Greece. The Greeks had a vast and visible population. So if we talk about the Olympians, the famous ones, of these ruling gods with Zeus and his company, we're still talking about the tip of the iceberg, because there were deities everywhere. So let's just keep this in mind, that if you went to a grove, there was a deity of the wood. You mentioned Shakespeare. Shakespeare has these wood nymphs. We know this from other cultures. Or a river had its own deity, the river god, or a spring would have a nymph goddess. That is also saying that nature is sacred, by the way, to explain how the world works. It's divinely charged. There are minor deities called demons. That's what the word demons means. It means divinity, gods. And in Greek, it's spelled D-A-I-M-O-N, and it means a divinity. But we can call them lesser divinities because they're not these famous characters you see, but these daimones in Greek, or demons, could act as intermediaries between sky and earth. And the Olympian gods are called Theos, T-H-E-O-S is the Greek word for God. Theos is in the word theology. So you have these gods, and you have this whole company of daimones who are not clearly personalized, not well defined. And, of course, that was neutral. Daimon was a deity. It got demoted with the coming of Christianity. How did that word change? They said, these are not real gods. These are heathen imposters. Banish them. And they became demons. It became a bad word, right? You can say Christians cast the pagan gods from the sky to hell. They cast the fallen angels. The pagan deities became fallen angels. And demons became a bad word. Anyway, there are all these characters all over the place. Okay. So we won't talk about all them. But there's many more. Okay, two. We'll see a few. This is way too much to say now. That is, now if we talk about some of the main Olympians, sometimes we see their children who are minor deities of different types. Okay. Well, so what about the Olympians? What are main characters of Greek deities? The gods of Olympus. Well, the Greeks themselves thought that two early poets gave them their idea of the gods, what they were like. Described the gods as people with personalities, characters, like a big family that's arguing. And these are the poets Homer and Hesiod. Homer wrote, you know, the Iliad and the Odyssey, or maybe they're by different people, or maybe they're by a committee, who knows. And Hesiod wrote Theogony, the Greek account of creation, and his other big poem is called Works and Days, which has Prometheus, Pandora, and things we saw before. They're about contemporary, Homer and Hesiod, about 700 B.C., and for the Greeks, this was still ancient history. This was still prehistoric. They didn't really know who those poets were. They didn't really know when they were. And we still have a big mystery about that, which is why I work on them myself. I like mysteries or things that don't have a simple answer. But for the Greeks, this was their kind of early founding literature that spread and became Panhellenic, that spread around Greece. And it wasn't a Bible, there was no dogma, it was not fixed, it was very varied. Greece was very complex. Various places, various time periods over many centuries. But they thought that these early poets gave them the idea of what the gods were like. And these are literary portraits. So they're myths, they're stories. That might be a little different than Greek religion, which is how you actually worshipped when you made offerings in the ground and so forth. That's always a little different, the story of cult and religion. So when we have myth here, we mostly have literary stories, which was their religion, but also the poet could become creative and witty and clever and make a joke out of it and become kind of comical. So it's still religion, but it doesn't exactly coincide with actual religious practice, which is a different story. Okay, so we know the gods are anthropomorphic. What does that mean, anthropomorphic? Right, human form, and this is the famous Greek humanism. But didn't they have that before the Greeks? Mesopotamians had anthropomorphic deities too. And this may be very natural. People make gods in their own image. In myth, right? Religion says the opposite. But in myth, people make gods in their own image. They're like big people. So the Olympians, let's move to the Olympians. They are like a family, presided over by Zeus the father, with his siblings and children, being the other Olympians. They're also like a society. They're an image of human family or human society. Zeus is the king. with a council around him, maybe the aristocrats, the ruling dynasty. So the gods on Olympus are portrayed as a mirror of human family or human society. These myths we know developed in the Bronze Age in Greece, when in Greece itself they had palaces with kings. So Zeus is a king. The gods are, of course, like people. They're anthropomorphic. They have bodies. But they can't be totally like people. They have to be different. They're like people to show a lot about people, that the gods interrelate with people. The people make gods because of human concerns. But, of course, they're bigger and better, because people die. But the gods are immortal, which brings out the contrast with people. They didn't think people could become like the gods, but the gods being immortal just stresses that we are not, that gap. So the gods had bodies and they had blood, but they can't have our blood because our blood is mortal. You can shed the blood and die. So the gods have something flowing through their veins called ichor, I-C-H-O-R. Actually, I believe that's in this slide here. I have some spellings. There it is. And they eat and drink. The gods have bodily needs. They have passions, emotions, of course, love affairs, tempers, and they have to eat and drink, but they can't eat mortal food, because if you eat bread and if you eat plants, these are things that grow and die, like us. So that is, we're in nature, we're in time, and we eat things that are in time. But the gods are not. They eat immortal food. Ambrosia. Ambrosia means immortal in Greek. That just means food of the gods, basically. So they eat ambrosia and nectar. And, of course, they're bigger and stronger than people. They have powers. Sometimes they represent forces of nature, like Zeus sends lightning and thunder. Poseidon sends actually earthquakes, so sometimes they explain nature, and sometimes they relate to human psychology. Aphrodite is love, something about a drive in the whole universe, the force of love, things like that. So they do many things about nature and about people. Okay, these are some slides of things we said. And let's go through these, and I'll have to kind of skip around and try to say the high points, since we can't be here all week. Although I'd enjoy it if we could, you know. So, and of course, there's nothing better than just reading the Iliad and the Odyssey by Homer, right? But I read it for fun, and people say, "Oh, is this too hard? You know, how can I get into this?" These are books. We're an educated audience, right? These are great books because they're good summer reading. They're good beach reading to read for fun. Most entertaining books, right? You just use the glossary in the back when they mention all the different names, and that's all you need. Because it's no test. And so you'll appreciate it more. But when you read those kind of things, you have to remember that the Greeks had many pictures of the gods, and that, again, it's very various, and it may differ from cult practice, but they're literary gods, but they're still real gods. This is real religion. They really believed this, and often it's not so different than what we believe. That's one of my points. This is our tradition. Our religions go back to this time, and we have all these lots of things like this, different but similar and in a continuous tradition. Okay. So, Zeus. Here's Zeus, the king of the gods or father of the gods. Again, a mirror of human society. Of course, he's the typical sky god or storm god, which is the thing the Indo-Europeans brought in. But you also see in other cultures, like Yahweh in the Old Testament, Hebrew, or Marduk in Babylon. So that is not just Indo-European, but Near Eastern as well. So Zeus is epithets or nicknames, or descriptive names, like adjectives really, epithets, are the cloud gatherer, the thunderer, the father of gods and men. It's very patriarchal, needless to say. Here's a slide of him sending the lightning bolt. And the other slide is of Zeus enthroned, the king. And this is a golden ivory statue in the temple of Zeus at Olympia. Olympia is not the same as Mount Olympus. Mount Olympus is up in the north. So for the Greeks, this would be like the northern limit of civilization. Beyond the cities in Greece, up north, kind of the horizon, is Mount Olympus where the gods are, kind of the edge. And Olympia is a place in southwestern Greece where they worship Zeus. They worshiped Olympia and Zeus. That's what Olympia means, an adjective from Olympus. And inside the temple was this great golden ivory statue. So you see another attribute of Zeus. He's holding a staff of power, the scepter.
What's the source of this word temple?
Oh, that's a Latin word. Well, I don't know the etymology of the word, but the temple, a temple was the house of the deity. A temple in Greek and Roman was not where you worshiped like a congregation. It was the house of the deity. The Greeks have a different word, like a sacred place and words like that, holy place. It was the house of the deity. You didn't go in there for services or anything. It housed all the offerings to the deity. It was like a big treasure house. Okay, so he's got a big spear called a scepter, his staff of power. His power is based on strength, thunder and lightning, brute force. And actually, this statue is one of the seven wonders of the ancient world. No, oh no, these are all gone. What happens is they would melt down the metal to reuse it. And what would they do with it? They would make jewelry out of it, or if it's bronze, they would make cannonballs. That's what happens to culture. It turns into that sooner or later, right? Yeah, sure. And this is by the same sculptor, Phidias, who did the famous statue of Athena in the Parthenon. They actually found his workshop there at Olympia when he was working on this statue. You see, we could talk all day if we just mentioned one thing, so I'll try to be a little quicker. So this was one of the seven wonders of the ancient world, and we actually find this in Washington, D.C. What's modeled on this? The Lincoln Memorial. What does that do to Lincoln to make him like Zeus enthroned at Olympia, right? It deifies him, and that's called a hero. That's what the word Greek hero means. It means a saint, a human who becomes a god. So it heroizes a person, meaning makes a mortal like a god. It's the same as saint, really. And in Byzantine times, in the Greek Middle Ages, this is how they depicted Jesus, the ruler. The Greeks had a word for Zeus, the cosmocrator. I don't know if you remember that from the account of creation. Zeus rules the cosmos and establishes order, keeps order. So that's why you have to pray to him. And he's called the cosmocrator, the ruler of the cosmos. Well, if you go to a Greek church of Greek Orthodox Christianity, the church is a microcosm. And above, there's always a blue dome with Jesus, the ruler of everything, the pantocrator, ruler of all. So it's very, but it's very similar to this. By the way, okay? So these are more slides of Zeus with the eagle, one of his attributes, the king of birds, and lightning bolts. That's the spelling of that word cosmocrator, we were saying. Well, this shows something about where Zeus came from, because the figure of Zeus, this type of sky god, is paralleled in other cultures. One we said is Santa Claus, who has the reindeer, Donner, and Blitzen, meaning thunder and lightning, which is probably from old German deities. So it was found that there's a word in Sanskrit from ancient India, Diaus Pitar, means sky father in Indian. That is cognate. That's the Indian way to say what the Latins called Jupiter. So the Pitar for father, but it changes so you can't recognize what the original meaning was. But this would be comparative linguistics, that these are all Indo-European and have a common origin because there was migration into these different places in prehistory. So the name Zeus is actually related to that, to the Diaus part. And if you say Zeus father, it would be Zeus pater, Greek for Diaus pitar. And in German, Tiu is the sky god. What day of the week do we get from that? Tuesday is that day. So all those words are related linguistically, and the Indian actually tells us what the other ones mean, which change their sound. These are just some silly slides I found on the web from graduates. Okay, so he has these attributes. So one thing about Zeus is that he's kind of remote. He works on top of a mountain and sends down storms, and mostly bad weather, right? Rain. Well, sure, rain fertilizes the ground, but he's not really described that way. They don't play up that part of it, right? He sends bad weather. And we know this says something about people. Fear Zeus, right? Even the other gods are afraid of him. He threatens them in the Iliad. And he's up there like kind of like Yahweh in the Old Testament, because where does Moses go to meet God in God's office hours? Right? On top of Mount Sinai, right? And he sends plagues and whatever he wants down on you, and that shows you about what it's like for us down here, right? So Zeus is like all of those. And so he's pretty harsh. So in the Iliad, for example, you don't really see him coming to earth. He never comes to earth. He sits on top of mountains to watch things and manipulate things when he wants to. He's more remote. And that is, he is related to these natural forces, the way the world is, that he's not a god who's there to make things better for people. The world wasn't made for people. He's not there to make us happy, although religion evolved that way later. That's what we expect from religion. And we talked about that before. But here's the point, that if Zeus is all these natural forces, and it sounds kind of harsh, people say, well, is this religion not satisfying? Is this not moral? Didn't Zeus watch over justice? And were the Greek gods moral at all? Or were they all so bad that they had to be fired and downsized, right? Downsized from polytheism to monotheism, right? So the thing is, he is moral too. He does have some aspects relating to justice and human society, though this is very much debated. So here's a couple of examples. One would be if you swear an oath. Who do you swear an oath to? Right. And don't we still swear an oath on the Bible? So what happens if you swear to Zeus and violate your oath? Man be struck by lightning, right? People still talk that way, right? Well, that's why we swear on the Bible. Although I guess now you have alternatives, right? You can choose a secular alternative if you want to. I don't know what you'd be struck by in that case. But so he watches over oaths. He's watching if you're good or bad, like Santa Claus. Another one is hospitality. This was in the Greek flood story. There was a wicked man on earth, a cannibal. Zeus came down to check it out, disguised as a human being. This cannibal was mean to Zeus, and Zeus said, you better be nice to a guest, because a guest may be a god in disguise. That gives a rationale for Greek hospitality. Why should you be good? Because Zeus is watching. That's what we want in religion. And the Greeks had some of that, although it's very much debated, how just they are. Or if it's different than ours or not. Oh, by the way, Jesus says something just about the same thing, about a guest may be a god in disguise. I don't remember the passage, though. So Zeus could watch oaths, hospitality, right-doing. Kings had to be just because kings worked for Zeus, keeping order on earth the way Zeus kept order in the universe. Remember, the cosmos means ordered universe. So there are those aspects going from nature to justice in human society. Okay, let me say that later, okay, because the Aegis is something Zeus had, but he gave it to Athena, and we'll see that with her. That's a sign of his power. Yeah, good question, though. Let's see that later.
Let's go to this. So, I forgot what I was going to say there. But, now I remember. Zeus was not the ruler of everything. The gods, remember, were not the creators of the universe for the Greeks. The Hebrew Bible is the one that makes the big change about that. The gods were part of the world, and there were forces even higher than Zeus. So at one point, there's a fascinating scene in Homer's Iliad. Zeus has a son who is a demigod on earth who's fighting on the Trojan side in the Trojan War, and his son is killed, and Zeus wants to save him from death. And Hera says, Zeus, even you cannot change fate. Fate is stronger than you, right? Because he didn't create everything. What is fate?
Fate is what runs the universe. In this case, fate means people have to die. That's our fate. He cannot change the boundaries between people and gods. So the gods, again, make a real point about mortality by being the opposite, that we cannot attain. Well, Zeus is like a person, though, and Zeus does have all these human foibles, of course, which make them funny stories. So there are many stories about Zeus's love affairs. And we already know he's not perfect, as we said. So he has a variety of wives, lovers. Consorts is kind of a term they use to try to be neutral, right? He even had a boyfriend. Zeus took a liking to a Trojan youth named Ganymede and carried him up to heaven to be cupbearer of the gods. So, by the way, there are stories that a god, if the god really wanted to, could make you immortal as a special dispensation. But as a rule, they couldn't, and that's why he's warned not to in the case we just mentioned. And these things happen in early times that you could pluck someone up to immortality, like we saw with the flood stories. It was very early for the survivor of the flood, but after that, not. So you have some cases like that, and that's his boyfriend, Ganymede, Zeus and Ganymede, in a statue found at Olympia. Of course, that relates to Greek society as well, famous pederasty institution. Then he had various wives. One is named Themis, which means law or justice, so there again showing he has something to do with justice. And their children are the Fates and the Seasons, which, however, relates to nature and not human justice there. He had a wife named Memory, Mnemosune, and their daughters are the Nine Muses. And the Muses being daughters of Memory is interesting, because when you read the Iliad and Odyssey and Hesiod, it will say, Muses, tell me the story. It never says this is by Homer or Hesiod. It says, Muses, sing the tale. The Muses are the singers, they're the authors. That's the way they passed down this oral tradition throughout the centuries. The Muses are the daughters of Memory. The saying was handed down in oral tradition and passed down. So those are various wives of Zeus. And there are other ones. And of course, you know, he's married to Hera, his sibling. Hera, in most of these stories, like in the Iliad of stories of the society of gods on Olympus, Hera is clearly subordinate to Zeus there. Zeus, at one point, even says to her, sit down and shut up. So it's a bad marriage, ironically, because we think of her as the goddess of marriage. But no one deity is that simple. It's not one thing like that kind of formula we always hear. So you see her arguing with Zeus, and you mostly see Hera being jealous of Zeus's affairs. So then Zeus has various love affairs with women on Earth, and lots of demigods and children on Earth, and Hera is always prosecuting them. And the most famous one is Hercules that we'll see next time, right? So these are some slides of Hera. There are really not all that many images of Hera. But at Olympia, there were temples of both Zeus and Hera. There was the big temple of Zeus with that statue inside that we saw, and next to it was a temple of Hera. And in front of the temple was the altar, because the altar was always outside where you did the sacrifice, by the way. People didn't go inside for service. But you had a sacrifice outside. The temple faced to the east, and the altar was out front to the east. And this is just, by the way, what do they do today at the temple of Hera in Olympia? Do you know what this torch is? They're lighting this torch. Yeah, what is that? That's the Olympic torch. That's where they light it every Olympiad and then race it around to where the games are. So this is like a revival of paganism, and the Olympic revival very much was part of this revival of pagan ceremonies in the 1890s.
That doesn't look much like a symbol of a female.
Well...
Torch.
No, there's nothing female about the torch, no. But it's not male either. It's just, fires, doesn't have a gender, okay. And Hera is a god, thought of as a goddess of marriage, but she does not have many children with Zeus. Sorry? Okay, let's say Poseidon, the other main powerful male god, somewhat similar to Zeus, is Poseidon, who of course is called what in Latin? What's his other name?
Neptune.
He's a sibling almost as powerful as Zeus. There was a story that they took lots, and Zeus got the sky, and Poseidon got the sea, and Hades got the underworld. Poseidon even looks like Zeus. Actually, at one point it says he's older and more powerful than Zeus in one passage. So that's, let's just say, they're kind of equal. And Poseidon, we know, okay, he's the god of the sea. But it's never one thing. It's not such a simple formula like that. Because Poseidon is also the earth. Poseidon also does earthquakes. He sends earthquakes. He's called the Lord of the Earth, or the Earth Shaker. And he's associated with horses. Why is that? Well, stampedes of horses make the earth shake. And how could that be related to the sea? Here you might guess. But if he's these powers of the earth, the sea is like these under the earth, some kind of powers in the earth, you could say, is Poseidon's realm. He even appears as a horse sometimes, and some stories about how he comes to some woman or mates with a mare or something when he's a horse. Okay, so here is a famous statue of Poseidon that you can see in the National Museum of Athens. It's called Poseidon, but now people aren't sure who it is. Because if it's Poseidon, what would he be holding? Like Zeus has the scepter, the trident, which is a fisherman's thing. So that's like his scepter, meaning his staff of power, but relating to his realm, the sea. Okay, now, but this shows you hurling something. Do you think you'd hurl a trident? Right, would you rather put a thunderbolt there, right? You hurl a thunderbolt. So that's what I think. I've always thought this was Zeus. And if you go to the museum now, they changed it in recent years, because a lot of people said that, and now it says Poseidon or maybe Zeus. And it just shows again how they look kind of alike, these two powerful males, siblings, almost equal. And they found this in the sea, in an ancient shipwreck found at the bottom of the sea, in recent times, I think the 60s. And it's an ancient bronze. It's a rare one that survives, because they would reuse the bronze. The crusaders would come, or people would be fighting, and what happened to all these bronze statues, they would melt them down and make the bronze into cannonballs. That's sad lesson about civilization. So, but this one was lost in a shipwreck, and it was lost for them but found for us. So I think they pulled it out of the sea, and that's why they said, okay, Poseidon. But on the web here, I found what he's really doing, because you can find anything on the web nowadays. Right? He's really barbecuing. Okay, let me see. So, like Karl Marx said, history always repeats itself. The first time it's tragic, the second time it's comic, right? Have you heard that one? Okay, and here are slides of Poseidon with the trident and seahorses, and he has a wife and a son named Triton. So where did we see Triton in a blockbuster movie? Right? What movie is this? Little Mermaid, the king of the sea, is named Triton. Why do you think they made him the king of the sea instead of Poseidon or Neptune? I think the name just sounded better. Triton, they liked it. It's a sound, I think. Anyway, he was Poseidon's son originally. And if you go to Athens, there's a famous temple of Poseidon. Have you been there? At Sunion. You go down here to see the sunset at the southern tip of the cape over the islands. Yeah, beautiful. Lord Byron carved his name on one of the pillars that you can see there. You kind of have to know where it is. Yeah. So, well, Hades, we don't really have slides of. You're not supposed to see Hades. Right. His name may mean invisible. In Greek, if you take the H out, sometimes it's spelled without the H, and it was Aides, and that means invisible. It's not clear if his name means that, because it could just be a name, but a lot of times we try to make a name look like it means something, so it's possible. But I won't say a lot about him now. Okay, so I'll just mention, there's too many, I'll just mention Hephaestus, or in Latin, Vulcan. What is he a god of? Fire. He's a working god, so he's shown with a double axe. These are scenes of Hephaestus splitting Zeus's head for the birth of Athena. And he's a god of fire and smiths, metalworking. It's very unusual to have a god who does manual labor. Gods are not supposed to do that. They're supposed to be free and at ease and banqueting and joyous with Apollo playing music to them at their banquets. So they don't have to worry about people. And people can do the work for them and sacrifice to them. So that's a little bit unusual. And the gods made fun of Hephaestus. They laughed at him. They were not trained in sensitivity training yet. And he was lame. Zeus threw him out of heaven one time in a rage, and he hit an island and became lame. So they would laugh at him limping around. And him being lame may be saying something about the position of manual workers in Greek society. That was low class to be a manual laborer. So again, here he really has something to do with human beings, with the work of human beings. And so you find temples to Hephaestus in Athens, in the Smith's Quarter. This is actually the best preserved temple in mainland Greece. It's underneath the Acropolis, down near the center of ancient Athens. And this is right in the middle of Athens today, Temple of Hephaestus, where the Smiths were around there. Well, in return, the gods felt sorry for him. When he was thrown down and hurt his leg and came back up to Olympus, he came back drunk riding on a donkey. And by the way, there are ancient pictures of Jesus riding on a donkey, too. They made that connection. And they gave him, in compensation, Aphrodite to marry, the goddess of love and beauty herself. But they thought this was kind of comical, ridiculous idea, if Hephaestus married Aphrodite. Yeah, well, maybe he was nice, right? And Ares is the god of war, better known from Latin, really, Mars. For the Greeks, they did not glorify Ares. You don't really see temples of Ares. You'd have to do research to find a couple of places where they worshipped Ares. Even in the Iliad is a poem of war where you see the gods looking down and talking about it and intervening. And so you think, well, they're always fighting. Maybe they glorify Ares. That's what they want to do all the time. But at one point, Zeus says, Ares, all the gods hate you. You're the most hateful of all the gods because always dear to your heart are war and fighting and bloodshed. Why don't you give it up and give us some peace? Something like that. So the Greeks, in other words, they were always fighting, but they did not glorify it. They thought this was tragic. They thought this was life. They also didn't think there was ever going to be peace. This was just the way it was. But they regretted that, in other words. But the Romans, not the Romans. The Romans loved Mars, and the Romans glorified battle and conquest, and that's what they lived for. And March 1st used to be New Year's. That's the month of Mars. That's when the army would gather in Rome. And they were in Rome, they were gathered on the field of Mars, the Campus Martius. And this would be New Year's on March 1st when the new officials would take power. And they would vote, okay, what two places are we going to conquer this year and annex their territory to add to the territory of Rome? And so Mars is all under Mars. And so March 1st was like praying training for the army. And then it moved back to January 1st at one point because they wanted the army to leave earlier to go conquer Spain. They had to march longer, so they moved it from March 1st to January 1st to start to spring the army out earlier. Anyway, the Romans glorified Mars quite a bit. You don't see him as much in Greek, but there's a story of how he had an affair with Aphrodite, love and war. And but Hephaestus caught them, and Hephaestus was the worker. He made a fine this mesh net out of invisible chain link that was invisible but so strong, and trapped them in it. So that's like craft, the craft of Hephaestus, his skill and cleverness, being able to overcome brute force like Ares. So that's kind of mind over matter, and that's also a very Greek story that myths often praise cleverness. Ares and Aphrodite had their affair and had a daughter, Harmony. Okay, so I've got a bunch of other slides here. Let me show you another one. One second. Okay. So let's look at Apollo now, going through the main Olympians. How are we? Okay. Well, Apollo is also called Phoebus Apollo. Here he is. He's a beautiful youth. He's not shaved, so he's always an ideal youth. And this is a famous statue of him from 5th century classical art, looking beautiful, serene, unconcerned. And this is actually from the Temple of Zeus at Olympia, where Zeus was sitting inside in the golden ivory statue. Outside was this scene with Apollo in the center. And it's a beautiful picture of the Greek art, the serenity and the beauty of the Greek art gods as ideal people. because here he is with the battle of the centaurs and these women around him, and he's keeping peace above it all, without his hair being disturbed, right? So he's this ideal youth, and you find these statues in Greek art called a kouros statue, which means a young man, and these are always found in sanctuaries of Apollo. They were dedicated to Apollo. Maybe the young man died, or maybe he won an athletic victory. You want to honor him in some way, so you put up his statue dedicated to Apollo. The most famous one, or at least around here, the most famous one is in the Metropolitan Museum. The one on the left here is called the New York Kouros. They used to think they were Apollo, but now they don't, but they're young men associated with Apollo. This may be a vase painting, a cup, showing Apollo pouring a libation to himself, which would be unusual. But Apollo is a god of music as well. He's here with a tortoiseshell lyre. He has a laurel crown. The laurel plant is sacred to Apollo. And so they would have these musical festivals, competitions of musicians. These were under Apollo. Apollo was a god of music and other things. So if you won the musical contest, you won the laurels. You got a laurel crown. You don't, right? Don't we say you win the laurels? Or what? Okay, so his music and poetry, because ancient poetry is also into music, the lyre. And what do we what's the term for a poet who is blessed by Apollo, the best poet, who has the laurel crown, right? The poet laureate means the poet crowned with laurel, mini crowned by Apollo. Right? It's like you have the power of Apollo. Okay, so we said Apollo's music, poetry. He's also knowledge, especially knowledge of the future, oracles and divination. You go to him to ask questions about what will happen in the future at the oracle of Apollo at Delphi. The Delphic oracle is an oracle of Apollo, where there's actually a temple of Apollo. And inside the temple of Apollo is the rock that Cronus vomited up, that he swallowed in place of Zeus, and then vomited up when Zeus came back. And that's in the middle of the temple where the priestess sat, and you would go there and ask her a question, and Apollo spoke through her, and that was the Delphic Oracle. We won't go through the whole Delphic Oracle now. But that was his main cult place at Delphi, where he's associated with knowledge. So these are, again, some general features of Apollo: music, knowledge, poetry, healing. Also, healing comes under Apollo. And these are all types of human arts. This is a culture, high culture, orderly creations by people. That is his music, but it would be like classical music. It would not be like rap or something. So, well, he's not exactly the sun, because they had a son, Helios. Well, at some point, he became identified with the sun. He was not originally the sun, but that happened at one point. Since he also is light, and all these things are about light, light is an image of progress. This is an early statue of him in ivory and gold. His mother is Leto. Zeus and Leto are the parents of Artemis and Apollo, who are two twins. Let's skip this. He was born on the island of Delos, and there's a little hymn about that tells that story. And then he moved up to take Delphi. And there's a little myth about how he took Delphi, and that became his sacred spot where the oracle was. Well, he traveled up to Delphi looking for a place to found a temple. When he came to Delphi, there was a giant snake on the ground called the Python. There's a map of Delphi. He was born in the islands down south of Athens there. And Apollo had a battle with the Python and shot the Python with his bow and arrow, because Apollo was also the archer, the far shooter. That's also connected with his healing. He could heal you with his arrows, or he could send disease and plague. So he's called the one who shoots from afar, things like that. This could be good or bad. And so anyway, he's an archer, and he shoots the Python, who's this snake. This shows their contest, and this shows them fighting over a tripod. A tripod is a symbol of victory. This is who's going to get the victory and get Delphi. The tripod would be a prize they actually gave. So this is a story about how Apollo took Delphi. And people try to make a big deal out of this story of what we were talking about in the beginning. That this may show something about the history of religion. The python is an earth deity. It's chthonic, relating to the earth, a snake. And it was actually female, a female snake. Well, maybe there were these earth deities. And then at one point, the Indo-Europeans came in, bringing in Zeus and the sky gods and the Olympians. What happens? Then Apollo comes to Delphi and shoots the snake, and the sky gods take over from the earth god. So people often use this as an allegory for this possible move. Maybe that's too much to build on that one story. But because of this, he took the name Pythian Apollo. And he established his cult at Delphi, where there was a temple, and inside the temple was a woman called the Pythia, which means the woman who works for Pythian Apollo. And Pythia actually means a female Apollo, because she was the oracle, this woman priestess, who was the only one to go into the inner room where that sacred stone was. And people from all over Greece would come and ask her questions. And a priest would bring the question into her in the inner room, and she would utter an oracle. And this was coming from Apollo himself. It was Apollo speaking through her. And the Greeks really believed this. The Greek literature is full of stories of these oracles. How do you interpret them? What are the gods trying to say? What are these oracles famous for? They are riddling. They're hard to understand. Why is that? Because we can't always understand the ways of the gods. Well, maybe the gods are speaking to us, but they don't tell us exactly what to do. We still have to figure it out, and we may be wrong. We may be fallible. Because it's hard to interpret the will of the gods. It's inscrutable. That's behind a lot of these oracle stories. And also at Delphi, this place was where they had games every 4 years called the Pythian Games, just like the Olympic Games at Olympia. And this is where you win the prize of the laurels. You win the laurels at these games. And there were more cultural things, music and poetry, because Apollo presided over that. Uh-huh. Well, we can't say the whole thing about how the oracle worked. Here's a slide of the temple of Apollo at Delphi. But it was a woman who had to be past childbearing age. That's possibly because the blood was polluting in a sanctuary, because blood represents time and mortality, and this is a sacred spot that's immortal and out of time in a way. That's what the whole idea of the gods is, a sacred place. But she's not a deity. She's a priestess, and Apollo is speaking through her. Apollo is the one speaking. You believe her because it's coming from Apollo. It's a god. It's God speaking. But it's through a human intermediary. And there's a view of the temple of Apollo at Delphi, where the oracle was in the inner room, right back here. And the Greeks themselves didn't even know how the oracle worked. And that's a fascinating story, and there's a recent book about that called The Oracle, right? This is a view of... This is actually seen from an ancient tragedy. This is a picture of a play on stage of somebody consulting the oracle, where she has a laurel branch. And there was one story that she munched on laurel branches and consumed these laurel branches, and that's how she became possessed by Apollo, because the laurel tree was sacred to Apollo. So if you take these in, that was a way of them saying she had Apollo inside her, that it was a magical, sacred plant to give her the powers of Apollo. Uh-huh. Go ahead.
She must have heard something in there that she would interpret.
Well, it all came... Well, she didn't hear anything. It came out of her. She spoke it, and that was the god speaking. She was possessed. It was inside her.
She really believed it was Apollo?
Of course. Well, it was. It was Apollo. Yeah. Uh-huh.
In Seven Hills, there are the remains of an ancient Greek, the home of an oracle.
Yeah, the symbol of Cumae near Naples.
Yeah.
Well, that's right. There were many oracles around the ancient world. They believed these.
But if you go into it, you go into the chamber where the oracle was sitting.
Yeah.
And you have somebody stand out near the entrance, you can hear, the oracle could hear everything that was being said in the antechamber.
Yeah, okay.
And the interpretation that I have heard going through was that the oracle was not necessarily as clairvoyant as one might have thought, that she could actually
Well, maybe, but what we want to do is be cynical, and it only works if you believe it, and they really believed it. I mean, we have things like this today. People rub statues for good luck, and people do all kinds of things today. People go to places where they think Mary is appearing in a cloud, you know, and take bus rides there. So it all depends on what you want to believe. That's religion, right? You know, do you say virgins can give birth or virgins can't give birth? It all depends on what you believe, you know. So, and what we, you know, so it depends on what skeptical you want to be. But we can't totally rationalize it or try to say it was a fraud or something. It was real for them, just like our religion is real for us, and we have things other people wouldn't believe. So let me just say two stories of Apollo, because this is a class of stories about the Greek deities. There are stories, of course, about their love affairs, and there were, let me tell you one now, brief, about Apollo. Apollo was in love with a woman named Daphne, but she swore to be chaste and not to have any man, or not to let any man have her. And so she was being chased by Apollo. And Apollo was desperate, he was pathetic, and he said, "I am the god of healing, but I am in love and I cannot cure myself of this wound." And she runs to her father, who's a river god, and he says, "I'll do something." And she turns into a tree. And Daphne is transformed into the tree. And Apollo runs up to her. And this is a statue by Bernini from the Baroque period. And Apollo says, "If you cannot be my woman, at least you will be my tree." And this is a story of why the laurel tree is sacred to Apollo, because Daphne is Greek for laurel. So that's actually kind of a, you know, the Greeks knew the laurel tree was sacred to Apollo because it was a sacred plant. And later on they made up this story to try to explain that in a cutesy way, because they forgot why it was a sacred plant from way back. And that story is told by Ovid, who wrote a Latin poem called The Metamorphoses, right? Which is one of our major sources, where it retells many Greek myths, and each one involves a transformation and metamorphosis. So there are an endless number of these stories. Let me tell you two more, and then take a break in a couple of minutes. So, with the Greek gods, you have this other type of story, besides all the love affairs and things, which is called a hubris story. That someone has arrogance and challenges the gods in a contest. And that's called hubris, to have excessive pride, arrogance. It means to go too far and to pass the limits. So you have a lot of these hubris stories. We mentioned once before, I remember, right? That one is that there was a satyr named Marsyas. Satyrs are these beasts, like goat men, they're not fully human. He plays this double flute, and he claims he can play better music than Apollo. So they have a contest, Apollo wins, you can see which one is Apollo here. As isn't this like the good guy versus the bad guy? Civilization, very proper, sitting down with a lyre. Civilization defeating a barbarian. That's the kind of story the Greeks liked, right? Because these are the Greeks, and these are the non-Greeks. The civilized versus a barbarian. He forces Greek culture. He supports Greek culture. So Apollo defeated him, and for his arrogance, he skinned him alive. There he is in the Renaissance art. And there's another story of a woman named Niobe who bragged because she had 12 children, 6 boys and 6 girls. She bragged that she had more children than Leto, who was the mother of Apollo and Artemis. Well, this was true, but you're not supposed to say this, like you're better than a goddess. So Apollo and Artemis were both archers, and they shot down the 12 children of Niobe. Apollo shot the boys and Leto shot the girls. And by the way, if young girls died, they might say, "Oh, she was shot by the arrows of Artemis." And Leto herself was changed into a rock, where if you go to Turkey, you can see high up in a mountain cliff, this rock cliff face with water always trickling down. That's Niobe weeping. So I saw that once. So you're punished, and these are, again, moral lessons. This is not the way the gods enforce morality, because this is a lesson for people. And these were all great myths because they're about people, and not just about some silly goat man or, you know, magic or cute stories. These are about people. Do not challenge the gods. Know who you are. Know yourself. This Greek motto, know yourself. You're down here. You're mortal. They're up here. You can't bridge that. That ties in with what we said before. Okay, let's take a break now. And this is just Apollo's son Asclepius, the god of healing, that we won't go into, but again, that comes under Apollo as healing, and his son had these shrines where you could go for healing shrines. So let's take a 10-minute break. Okay, you can ask questions during the break. Okay, welcome back. So we're going to say whatever we can in the time left. And there have been a lot of questions during the break. The best thing you can do is just read about all this. It's very complicated. If you read the Iliad, that's sometimes comical. It's by a poet. It's fiction, but it's also real. The gods are real because they say a lot about the world. Did you have? Okay, let's save the questions to the end. We had said that before. Okay, so let's go to a few main ones. I mean, a few that we can do in the time, a few examples. We said something about Artemis, the twin of Apollo. Aphrodite, we know, is the goddess of love. We saw how she was born from the sea. So I'm not going to go through all these now. Let's go to Athena, and then Demeter, and Persephone, which has a lot of interest for women, and men too, and Dionysus, who's always fun. Okay. So Athena is the daughter of Zeus. We know how she was born. She was actually born from Zeus's head without a mother. The mother had been eaten by Zeus. And she has another name, Pallas Athena, or in Latin, she's called Minerva. By the way, this name Pallas, that gives us the word Palladium. Remember, there used to be a big club in New York with that name. That was under Athena, right? Right? And she was born fully grown and fully armed. Athena is a warrior above all. She's a warrior goddess. She's actually very masculine because she has a father only and she has this male function of a warrior. So she's not a mother. She's a virgin. And the word for virgin is Parthenos. That's what the Parthenon means. A temple of Virgin Athena. And after paganism ended, who did that become a church of? It went from a temple to a church. It got taken over by the new religion. It went from Virgin Athena to Virgin Mary. And it's maybe not a coincidence, maybe not totally unrelated. Virgin goddess. But again, people say, well, here's a woman at the top of Athens, because Athens was her main city. She was the main deity of Athens. So, by the way, that's a reminder that religion varied from city to city. There was no one country of Greece. It was never a unity politically. You had Athens, Sparta, Argos, hundreds and hundreds of cities all over the map dotted around. And that was the case until the 19th century. So, in many places, that is. That is, nation-states didn't really develop until the 19th century. So she had Athens, and Athens is named after her, or possibly she was named after Athens. And so here's the thing. You have this goddess at the top of Athens, a female over Athens. Does that show women were really powerful in Athens? Right? Well, why? Were women powerful in Athenian society? Right? So if you have a goddess on top, does that religion have to correspond exactly to society? I mean, in the Middle Ages, you had Virgin Mary, who was often more important than anybody, but were women very free and advanced in the Middle Ages? No, so it doesn't always correspond. So, and also, Athena is not that feminine. She's not a mother. She's not nurturing. If we want to say those are typically feminine anyway, that she is a warrior. She's very masculine. There's a term for this. This is called the Margaret Thatcher syndrome. In a male-dominated society, for a woman to be powerful, you have to be like a man. Margaret Thatcher didn't have one woman in her cabinets ever, you know. So that's what it's like. So, you know, so it's ambiguous. Okay? She has these symbols of power you see with a spear, helmet, shield, and the aegis. The aegis is a breastplate she wears that was given her by Zeus. It was a goat skin with snakes at the fringes. And it's shown different ways in art. It's always here. And the Medusa head was inside. This is after the hero story that's coming up in the future for us, that a hero beheaded Medusa and gave the head here. Medusa turns you to stone. So this is to ward things off, to be fearsome. And this is art by Klimt. Remember Klimt? You see, this is popular in posters, right? The Kiss, things like that. That's his Athena. So the aegis is a symbol of power. And this is where we get the term today. If you do something under the aegis of the Madison Public Library or whatever. So then you can easily identify Athena. Do you see Athena in this slide? This is a scene of the Battle of the Gods and the Giants, one of the mystical stories of how the Olympians defeated others and established their rule at the end of the creation stories. The gods defeated the giants. And here's Athena, because you can always see this breastplate with different tassels or snakes shown different ways, like that. Here she is. She's a warrior goddess. There's the aegis. And these two holes would have held a Medusa head, which is missing from that one. Okay, she's also got the owl, and that became the symbol of Athens, the owl of Athena. Also the olive tree, because they had a story that Athena and Poseidon had a contest, which one would become the main deity of Athens, which one would get Athens. So they had a contest. The Athenians said, what can you do for us? Poseidon took his trident and struck the rock of the Acropolis, and salt water spring gushed forth. And miraculously, if you go to Athens, you can still see the spot. You can see the mark of his trident on the rock today. It's still there. They built around it and left, they built a building over it, but left a hole in the floor. You can look down on this special spot. This is proof. And then, but don't our religions today depend on ancient miracles? So which ones do you want, right? So what's wrong with these, right? They believed it. And Athena gave them what did she give in this contest with Poseidon? The olive tree. And she won. The olive was basic to the economy of the Athens region. And so that's why this shows her with the olive tree and the owl. And I'll show you a picture of that where the contest was. Here's the olive tree of Athena. They built this building around it. The famous building with the female columns, not related to Athena themselves. Poseidon's trident struck here. There's a mark down there. And that's her olive tree, but that's not the original tree. And the Parthenon, this will be the Parthenon off to the right. So that's up on the Acropolis in Athens, the city of Athena. Where up top you had the Parthenon, the temple of the Virgin. And you had different names for Athena up here. Athena the Virgin, Athena Polias, the protector of the city. Polis is city. P-O-L-I-S means city. Of course, we get politics from that word and from the Greeks. And also, you have up here, warrior Athena, Athena Promachos, was a big statue in the middle of the Acropolis, which is missing, which was actually the centerpiece of the whole hill that's long gone, melted down for cannonballs during the Crusades. There's a reconstruction of it. And that's another reconstruction of it. Parthenon. Scenes on the Parthenon showed the birth of Athena and also the contests of Athena and Poseidon. So yes, somebody asked, what were these temples used for? The temples projected myth all over. The temples, if they were expensive ones, it would be decorated with sculptures. These sculptures were scenes of the gods and heroes, myth and religion. Inside was this famous statue of Athena by Phidias, who did the one of Zeus we saw, made of gold and ivory. Well, this is long gone, but you can see it in Nashville, Tennessee. They rebuilt it where they have a life-size Parthenon they built for the centennial, I think, 1893. And the statue was just built in the 80s. And it's known what it was like, even though it's gone from ancient copies. Okay, well, let's get into that. Okay, now Athena was also involved with weaving. So she was a woman, but her main sphere was that she presided over domestic chores of women, like weaving. In all these stories, you see women at home weaving, women keeping the house. And in other words, we say Athena is wisdom, but it was not that simple. They didn't have this kind of formula, and her wisdom was this kind of craft, more like practical intelligence, these skills. I think it's later that, maybe with Minerva, or later, a long tradition, Athena became wisdom because the owl is wisdom. But the Greeks, you know, she was not all wisdom for the Greeks, but particular types.
And there's a story of a woman named Arachne who challenged her to a weaving contest, and was that's a hubris story, and she was turned into a spider. Hence, named after her are arachnids, right? Okay. Now people ask, are the gods real? Did they believe these? Are these just made up by people for human needs, of course, right? And this is a famous statue of Athena mourning for the war dead of Athens. She's mourning at a tombstone listing the war dead. And this is very remarkable, to have a goddess who cares about people. And that's Greek humanism again. And the famous line from Virgil, there are tears for passing things. Mortal things do touch the mind. Because people say, if you die, what's the point? Well, the Greeks made it beautiful. They made art out of tragedy. That's one of the points of all of this as well. That's the theme of Homer's Iliad. Okay, so brief run through. Okay, good. Now we have time for a story of Demeter and Persephone. Okay? So, of course, these are all Olympians we're naming. Demeter is a sibling of Zeus, who is one of the Olympians, and the goddess of grain, agriculture, right? And especially what part of agriculture? The grain, the products that you eat. She had a daughter, Persephone. Oh, let's see. Okay, sorry. So here I have lots of slides. So I'll skip to this one. Demeter and Persephone are sometimes called the goddesses. And sometimes they're just called Demeter and daughter. Kore in Greek, K-O-R-E. This is a young girl, is another name for Persephone. Demeter and Kore. The goddesses, or the two goddesses. That is, both fertility goddesses are linked closely together. And you see Demeter sitting here with an ear of wheat. Well, there's a story called the Homeric Hymn to Demeter. This was an ancient hymn. It was actually not by Homer, but that's what it's called because it's written in the style of Homer by this later group of poets that followed Homer. And this talks about how Persephone was one day plucking flowers with various nymphs and goddesses. When Hades came up from the underworld and abducted Persephone, the rape of Persephone by Hades. Rape means abduction. Like, what's the word? Raptor, like a raptor dinosaur. Means snatching. Like the rape of Helen. The Greeks would call it the rape of Helen when Paris took Helen to Troy. I mean, it doesn't mean he forced her on the spot right there, like we think of. It's a little different than we think of it, right? It could mean he fucked someone to be your wife. So he took her to be the wife of Hades, and she becomes queen of the underworld. And this scene of her plucking flowers when he rapes her is an image of her loss of innocence. Plucking the flowers, like deflowering, or your loss of childhood innocence. This is a rare ancient painting, since paint does not survive well. And this painting was found in the 80s in a group of royal tombs from the family of Alexander the Great up north in Macedon. They found these royal tombs. It may be the tomb of Philip II, the father of Alexander the Great. And it's from the 330s BC, from that dynasty. It may be his tomb or may not be. But it's very rare to have the actual painting preserved. From the 330s BC, classical Greece, the rape of Persephone by Hades, and this is one of her girlfriends she was playing with. And it's a great scene of motion. And, by the way, maybe you can think of Roman frescoes, Roman wall paintings like Pompeii, and so on. Well, what happened was the Romans conquered Macedonia. It was the first place in Greece they came to conquer, so they got a lot of their painting styles from here. It's earlier than Roman painting, but you could say it's background to Roman painting. So notice Hades is bearded, looking like Zeus and Poseidon. This is from Baroque by Bernini, who also did that Apollo and Daphne. He did a lot at St. Peter's at the Vatican, right? And here's
Hades looking a little more like the devil, maybe. So Persephone goes down to Hades, and she becomes the queen of the dead. You have Hades and Persephone ruling the dead as king and queen. But what is this about? Because she's a fertility goddess. Well, life and death are related, and that's the point of the story. So back on Earth, her mother Demeter doesn't know what happened to her, and she's wandering. She comes to a place, Eleusis, where she is mourning. Demeter turns into an old mortal woman. So she acts like a human. She takes on human qualities. Aging. And she's an old woman. Grief. Grief for somebody who kind of died. It's like her daughter Persephone died when she went to Hades. Goddesses are not supposed to experience this. There's a little side story at this point, and it's a very good story. Demeter is disguised as an old woman, and she comes at rest at a place named Eleusis, which became her major cult place. And this partly story is explained why the cult started there, because she was there. It's found that it was a result of this story. So anyway, while she's at Eleusis, these princesses come out, and they say, oh, you're an old woman, we can use you to nurse the baby in the palace. So they bring her in to nurse this baby boy. Demeter is nursing a baby boy while she's in grief for her daughter, and every night she burns this boy in the fire to try to make him, what would fire do to you? What if a goddess burns you in the fire? Fire could be immortal, right? We have sacred fires. This is a way to make him immortal, burning off his mortality maybe. Besides that, fire has all these sacred associations because people think it's in the sky and it's not totally physical. It seems special and spiritual, ethereal somehow. So she's going to make this boy immortal. But the mother sees what's happening and says, oh my Zeus, what are you doing? And she makes her stop. And Demeter says, oh, just for that, he's not going to be immortal. And to make him immortal, she was anointing him with ambrosia. And the word for anointing is Christos, right? The one who's anointed. So she was going to make this boy immortal. He might be like a divine child, but can you have that in Greece? Can you have a divine child who becomes a savior and an example for everybody else that they can become? No, you can't have that. So it's failed. It's a story of failed immortality. The boy cannot be immortal. He's mortal. And these are Greek stories. Mortals are mortals. They're not gods. Okay, so that's a side story, but it's actually very central to the whole theme of what happened to Persephone, because Persephone is underground. Can she come back up? It's like she's dead. Can she come back to life? So now Demeter is mourning. She turns back to him, to a goddess, and says, look, it's me. Found my cult here. And it's a story of how they found these great mysteries called the Eleusinian Mysteries, which is a different story, but that became one of the most sacred places in the ancient world for 2,000 years. They would do special rites there related to Demeter and Persephone. Okay, we can say it later if you have questions after about that. So the story goes, now she's a goddess, she says, found my rights here. And she's mourning, so she stops crops from growing on Earth. She brings a famine on Earth. Out of her grief, she brings death to crops. So people are suffering, and even the gods are suffering because people cannot make offerings to the gods. Gods need those offerings. It's almost like feeding the gods or giving the gods something they need. So, of course, this is an allegory that Persephone is a fertility goddess while she's underground with Hades. It's like winter. No crops are growing on Earth. It's death, right, for that. So, finally, the gods feel sorry, and Zeus says, okay, we'll let her go. Send Hermes, the messenger god, to Hades. Tell him to release Persephone, because we need this stuff back the way it was. So Hermes goes down, tells Hades, okay, we have a message, you've got to release her, the big boss says. And Hades says, okay. But before he lets her go, he takes a pomegranate seed and he encircles it around her body, which is something magical, and he feeds her this pomegranate seed, the famous pomegranate. And Persephone goes back up to Earth, and she's reunited with her mother. And there's this great joyous scene. of mother and daughter, and to these two fertility goddesses. And this is some of the big evidence and the big thing you have to look at if you're interested in early goddesses. So, but there's more to it than just the gender issue, because it's about life and death. Demeter says, Persephone, oh, it's so good to have you back. We're really happy. We'll let the crops grow again. But first, tell me, did you eat anything when you were with Hades? Did he feed you anything? Oh, yes, I had a pomegranate seed. Oh, no, now you have to go back to Hades. So why is that? She said, if you ate anything with him, you have to go back. And this is when Zeus says, okay, she has to go back to Hades now because she ate the seed, which I'll explain in a second what I think about that. But first, Zeus makes a deal. Okay, she has to go back to Hades because of this. This bound her to Hades in a way. But Zeus says, okay, she'll be with Hades one-third of the year. The other two-thirds, she can go back to Earth and be with her mother Demeter. So the Greeks took that as a story about the seasons. When she goes down to Hades, it's like winter. It's a form of death. And there's no crops on Earth. When she comes back up, it's the beginning of spring. The flowers come back. We have Easter, a spring festival for the flowers. That's new life. That's what you celebrate, new life. Easter was a spring festival before it was the resurrection, which was also about new life of coming back from the dead. And there are lots of these ancient stories about gods who die and come back. And there's a lot of talk about whether that's like Jesus or it's like it, but is it different? And that's a topic of dying and rising gods. But let's say how that is all about life and death. Persephone is a fertility goddess. Demeter and Persephone give fertility. And at this point in the story, they say, okay, now we're happy, we'll let the crops grow back on Earth. And so they teach this boy to go around the world spreading grain and teaching grain to people. They spread agriculture. So they're fertility goddesses. Now maybe we want to say, well, fertility goddesses, women rule, and this is so beautiful, people would just worship that and not fight wars and so forth. Not rule like Zeus and with males. Okay. So, but here's the thing. This fertility is two-edged. It's a double-edged sword. Because she gives people grain. But what happens if you eat grain? You're not eating ambrosia. You die. People are called eaters of bread. If you eat these plants that grow and die, well, that means you're part of nature. You're part of the life cycle. Plants grow, they die, new plants come back. But the same plant doesn't come back. Right? So it's about this life cycle, the cycle of nature. People are part of that. And so whatever gives life gives death. Fertility goddesses are also death goddesses. That's why Persephone has to be in Hades part of the year. Because it's connected. Actually, she's not there because Hades raped her. She's there because fertility involves death. In ancient Greece, Persephone was the queen of Hades. Hades and Persephone ruled the underworld. And this is a story about how she gets back with her mother for part of the year. Now, why did eating the pomegranate fruit in the story, why did eating that seed make Demeter and Zeus say, okay, now you have to go back to Hades. Now you're stuck, you're bound to him by that eating of the seed. And this is a famous image today, right, the Persephone and the pomegranate. Well, I'll tell you what I think about that because you're sitting here and I'm talking. Okay. Well, people usually say, well, this is like a marriage ceremony. And in other words, they try to make it about human society, like when we talk about gender or when we say religion reflects society. But it's not just that. So I said, when she eats this seed, this makes her mortal in a way. This is what people eat. People eat seeds and bread and grain. Remember the story of Gilgamesh? The rotting bread is the passage of time. And the Greeks say you're eaters of bread. Plant eaters. That means you are what you eat. You're not eating the food of the gods. If you eat the food of the gods, you might be transformed into a god. But you're not. So I said Persephone ate a mortal fruit, and this is an explanation of her dying in a way and being stuck with Hades. But where does it get more interesting than that? Well, what happens to Adam and Eve? They are in the Garden of Eden. They're in a blissful state, a garden of the gods. The Greek word for garden is paradise. They're in this special state where they're living like gods. It never says they're gods, but they have this indefinite life and bliss and don't have to work. It's godlike. God says, don't eat from that tree. If you eat from that tree, you'll die. And don't eat from that other tree, because if you eat from that, you'd be a god. So you have food of the gods and food of mortals. What happens? The serpent comes and the snake comes and said, God doesn't want you to eat that, because you become a god. The snake doesn't lie to them, by the way. What the snake says is true. And it never says the snake is Satan, by the way. The more you look at it, the more complicated it is. Anyway, they eat the fruit, and God says, if you eat from that tree, you have to die, and they're banished. So I said, it's a very simpler idea. Persephone eats the seed, and they say, you have to go back to Hades. It's like dying. Most people take the Adam and Eve story as a story of law and disobedience. Okay, you disobeyed God, that's why you have to die. But God says, if you eat that, you're going to die. It's like the immediate result of eating it. So anyway, I tried to relate those, and a lot of people say, well, they're different, but sure, they're different, but still, maybe there is combination stories, because these are similar civilizations, combination themes, that is. They're civilizations close to each other. And so this story of Persephone and Demeter is about gender, the rape, and the mother-daughter reunion. And it's all, I would call that a kind of political, sociological, issue. It's also about existence, life, the cycle of the seasons. And more generally about life and death, whatever is born, dies, the whole cycle of life and death, not just the seasons, but the whole birth and death. So I did a little research on that. And they found it here at Eleusis, this thing called the Eleusinian Mysteries, where you went there to become initiated and learn some secret about life after death. So it's all about that. Persephone dies, can she come back? If you die, can you come back? If Jesus dies, he comes back. Does that mean you can if you're like him? You know. So this was a new thing in ancient thought that came in at this place with these mysteries. So there's actually a lot there. It's very rich, and that story is known from one poem called the Homeric Hymn to Demeter, which you can read for fun and find online in good recent translations, actually. And that's better than reading things about it. Okay, Dionysus, you like Dionysus? Okay, now let's pop up Dionysus for a little comic relief, but also serious as well. Okay? So this will actually be a lot to get in. I think we can get him in 15 minutes. Okay, Dionysus had another name, Bacchus. Now, we want to say Dionysus is the god of blank. Wine. But, right, Dionysus hired an advertising agency to come up with a slogan. And they said, Dionysus, you're a lot more than wine. You've got to get the message out. So he said, I'm much more than wine. Not just wine anymore. Because he is not just wine. Dionysus is about nature and growth and life. He is a fertility god. He is a male fertility god. So, by the way, males could be fertility too. And especially in ancient times, a little differently than we think of it today when we argue like the things we were talking about before. Anyway, Dionysus is a fertility god who's associated with the growth of nature. How is he different than Demeter? Well, Demeter was grain, what you eat, the products of agriculture. Dionysus is the life force itself, the liquid, blood, semen, sap in trees, this liquid that grows up in you. It's in wine, but wine is just one example of what he is. Wine has a special spirit in it. Dionysus. Wine has a special life force, a highly charged drink that you feel, you feel a special charge, special life when you drink it. You drink and you get Dionysus inside you from the wine, especially when you're drunk. And what do we call this today? You go to a liquor store, wines and spirits. What are the spirits? Dionysus. That's what that means. That's where it comes from. Right? It's Dionysus. So he's in all these things like liquids, like a life force, liquids related to growth, like sap rising up in trees, for example. Wine would just be one of many. So he's a male fertility god. He's also called Bacchus. Okay. Students think he's a frat boy. Great, we love Dionysus, spring break and all this. But he's more than a cartoon character. He is about nature. And by the way, he's a little bit androgynous.
that he's actually beyond, a little bit beyond male or female. He is a male with somewhat female appearance, somewhat androgynous. Okay, so there's a story about the birth of Dionysus. Zeus was having an affair with... Now, we have to remember that Zeus is a majestic god. Didn't do this all the time, but sometimes he got into funny situations. Zeus was having an affair with Semele, a princess of Thebes in Greece, a city north of Athens. And he was disguised as a man having this affair on Earth. So his wife Hera was jealous. That seems to be Hera's main job. She has a bad marriage. I don't know what kind of goddess of marriage she is, you know. But she says, she comes down to Semele, and she says, yes, you think that's Zeus, but lots of men will tell you that to sleep with you. So you have to make him prove it. Ask him to come to you as he comes to Hera in his full glory. So Semele says, can you show me? Oh, no, she says, will you do anything I want? Yes. Will you come to me as you come to Hera in your full glory? Oh, I have to, because I said yes, right? This is like the case of be careful what you wish for. So, how does Zeus come in his full glory? How does Zeus manifest his power? Lightning. And he basically fries Semele, who was pregnant, and he takes the baby and sews it in his thigh. So this is Dionysus. His parents are Zeus and Semele. Zeus takes baby Dionysus, or the fetus is not yet born. Dionysus is called the twice born because he has this strange kind of, he's growing in the womb in his mother, and then Zeus takes him up, and he's born out of the thigh of Zeus. What does this mean? Thigh is a euphemism for the genital region, right? There's actually a Hittite god. The Hittites are people in Turkey who gave birth through his penis. It says he gives birth through the good place. That's a euphemism. And so what does this mean? That they're actually... So again, Dionysus is a male fertility god. He's born from a man. So Zeus has some fertility power, and Aphrodite was born from his head. Athena was born from the head of Zeus. Aphrodite was born from her father's genitals, and Dionysus is born from Zeus's thigh. Three of the Olympians are born from men without a mother. So of course you could say this is just men being brutish and patriarchal, but it's also saying, I think, that men have, there's some fertility power. You can have, a god could have unisexual, you know, or a goddess too, could have unisexual generation. And plus it's just weird, right? But, Hermes took Zeus out of, Hermes took baby Dionysus out of the thigh. Hermes is the messenger god who's shown here. This is Hermes taking baby Dionysus. Hermes has the winged sandals. Where do you see this today? In the Nike sneaker, the swoosh is a representation of the wing in Hermes' sandals. That's where they got it from. Nike means victory. That was in one of the slides with Athena. She had a little winged victory on her hand. That's Nike in Greek. And the winged cap. And this is a typical picture of Hermes. He has a cloak because he's a traveler, and a cap, which are traveler's clothing or shepherd. Mercury in Latin, exactly. That's where we get the word commerce, because he's the god of travelers. He's a messenger, so he protects merchants who travel. Commerce word comes from Mercury. He was also the patron of thieves. So what does that say about their view of business dealings? Okay. And he took the baby Dionysus to be raised by certain nymphs in the Far East, like in India or Persia. And Dionysus grew up in the East, because the Greeks thought he was very Eastern. He had to travel then through Asia to come back to Greece. And this little story will say, this is just a picture, another sculpture, Hermes with baby Dionysus. You couldn't even tell who they are here. They're fully human. And this is classical art where the gods are depicted as ideal humans. This was actually found in the Temple of Hera at Olympia. An ancient author said there's this best sculptures in this temple. An archaeologist found it in that very temple from the 300s BC by a famous sculptor. Okay.
So anyway, that's what that shows. And a lot of historians go nuts here because of the posture of Hermes, the way his legs are bent. If you study Contrapposto, that's what they talk about in art history, though. The pose is big. Okay. So Dionysus grows up in the East. This is a way of saying he's a fringe god. He's exotic. People used to think, well, Dionysus was maybe an Eastern god who was imported to Greece. But we don't think that anymore because he was found in some of the earliest Greek records showing he's really old. So now, this is taken a different way. The story that he grew up in Asia and is very kind of Asian looking here, and he travels through Asia to come to Greece, is taken as more, not historical fact, but more of an image of his foreignness and his exotic nature. Because he's related to some of these Asian goddesses, like Cybele, some of these fertility goddesses who command the animals, or have a chariot pulled by two animals, like two panthers. And this is all very Eastern garb for the Greeks. It's also saying he's effeminate, he's androgynous, because he's a male with fertility, he has both male and female. And he has a type of scepter, where deity has some kind of staff of power. And we've seen a few. So Zeus has a spear, Poseidon has a trident, and so forth. Dionysus has a thyrsus, it's called the thyrsus, which is a nature, because he's a god who commands nature. It's a fennel stalk with a pine cone on top and ivy wound around it. So it makes him a god of nature. And he's also shown here with a symbol, music, and dancing. Okay, so that's where he gets fun. Because he leads this band of revelers through Asia in a big procession where they're singing and dancing and going wild, possessed by Dionysus. Here's his band of followers who are possessed by him, called the Maenads. The word Maenad is related to the word mania, madness. But this is not a bad madness. This is a divine madness. Plato talks about the divine madness that poets have, divine possession, inspiration. It's kind of like this country western song, "It's a good thing I'm crazy, it keeps me from going insane." And so Dionysus is that side of life, the irrational. And it's saying this is part of life. That's what these stories are about. So they worked up in this frenzy. And these women are also called Bacchae, which basically means female Dionysuses. They are communing with the deity. They get worked up using music and dance into a state of ecstasy. Ecstasy means standing outside yourself in an altered state. And another term for that is enthusiasm. They have enthusiasm. That means you have the God inside you. The theos, as in the word theology, T-H-E-O-S, the God within, E-N, enthusiasm, right? Means the God within. They commune with him in a way and get into this frenzy by dancing. And by the way, there are other religious cults. This is a real religion. This is getting more religious, actually, here. There are other religious cults that do this, like the whirling dervishes use dance, or the shakers. Why are they called the shakers? They used to shake and work themselves up into this kind of state. So they're doing that. I'll show you a couple of other slides, and this one shows, of course, the ivy and the thyrsus and the wineskin, and his other followers are called the satyrs, or these goat men, very phallic, exaggerated. A lot of times people think they were having orgies, but they weren't having orgies. It's not explicitly sexual. I mean, you could say the whole thing is very sexual, you know, sexual type of emotions, but they're not engaging in that. The Greek word orgies meant excessive emotion. So these are called orgies for this kind of thing, but they weren't explicitly active. Okay, sexually. Okay, so these followers use music and dance, and here's a good one in a state of transport or ecstasy. Right, a couple of those. And this shows their outside society. Because these Bacchae would go to hillsides, to mountaintops, and it would be women only. Women would have these cults where they would go out to the hills and worship Dionysus, but only women. Notice here, they have one breast bare. This shows you outside of conventions. You're outside of the city, away from your home and your normal restrictions. So you get into a kind of a state of nature.
You get to act out something in these festivals. That is like what we do at holidays and festivals. Like we have Mardi Gras, we have Halloween where we act silly, but we're allowed to do it because we allow it at certain times with certain conventions of its own for that behavior. It's an outlet. So it's something like that. That is the way they recognize the irrational, the non-rational. So there's one quick story about that. So there are these stories about how Dionysus is coming with his train of followers through Asia. And one of these, by the way, is how he meets a king named Midas, who was a real king. And Midas was good to one of his friends, so Dionysus said, I'll give you anything you ask for. And Midas asked for everything he touched to turn to gold, and it was a disaster. It's really a Huber's story about how he's too arrogant and greedy. So if you see things today named the Midas touch or Midas mufflers, for the right? This means golden. Was that positive for the Greeks to be golden? Could you always have the gold and all you wanted? No, this was negative because the Greeks were tragic, that this was arrogance. You couldn't always have it all good. We say every dark cloud is a silver lining. The Greeks said every golden cloud is a dark lining. So so Midas and all these stories aren't the way they're taken today, like cartoon, but they're richer stories. Okay, so there are a few stories I'll tell you in 5 minutes, okay, maybe. Dionysus comes through into Greece. Many people resist him. They do not believe he's a real god. They think he's this Asian dandy, this effeminate fop, and these are wild orgiastic rites, that's the Greek word for it, orgies. And what are they doing with all these women dancing on the hills? Well, don't the men know about this? Call the men, call the police, and they should be home and not running around naked having orgies, and the men, they have all these bad impressions of it. So there are many stories about people resisting him and saying, you're not a god, and trying to take him on. The most famous one is a play called The Bacchae. This is a class of stories. The first one is in this, there's another one in this slide where he turns the whole crew of a ship into dolphins, one of the most famous Greek vase paintings of all. I should have worn my t-shirt of that today. And you see he's kind of a lord of nature there, right? So the most famous one is a play called The Bacchae by Euripides, one of the greatest Greek tragedies. Actually, one of the very last ones written about 405 B.C., The Bacchae. It was put on in Athens in the theater of Dionysus because Dionysus was the god of theater. Right underneath the Acropolis, they built a theater on the hillside, a semicircle, was the original theater. And it was a theater of Dionysus. It was within a holy sanctuary of Dionysus where theater and tragedies were put on. Because tragedies were about existence and life and death and all these things that Dionysus is about and Persephone is about. The tragedies gave you these kind of messages. So this is the only tragedy that's actually about Dionysus, even though all the ones we know, like Antigone, Oedipus, were all put on in the theater of Dionysus and had this Dionysus context, like we said. And tragedy actually arose out of Dionysus worship. Okay, drama arose out of that, which we won't get into. But here's the story of the Bacchae. The Bacchae is, by Euripides, that Dionysus has this whole procession of followers who come back from Asia to Thebes, where his mother was from. And he says, I'm home, I've come back to my hometown, I am the descendant of the king, worship me here. You should worship me and accept me as a god. And some people do. But his mother's sisters don't. And he maddens them and turns them into Bacchae, and they run wild out to the hills of Thebes. You're outside the city into the wild, which is always threatening, outside of male control. And the king of Thebes is named Pentheus. Pentheus wants to arrest Dionysus. He says, I am in charge here. I'm the ruler. I'm a man. Nobody will tell me what to do. You're kind of effeminate. You know, what are you? And I am reasonable, and we want reason and order in this city. And what are you doing driving these women crazy? They should be back home and keeping the house where they belong. You know, and so he represents, you can say, repression, reason exaggerated. A negative reason, not sympathetic to other sides of life. So he arrests Dionysus, but Dionysus escapes, because one word for Dionysus is the loosener, the freer. Of course, we know wine does that, and he himself could escape shackles. And he's actually
There are lots of parallels with Jesus, actually. Dionysus. Because Jesus came as a man, not everybody accepted him as a god, and some did. And he had to perform miracles to prove he was a god. That's what Dionysus does here. And by the way, this play, the Bacchae, in the Middle Ages, it was rewritten about Jesus. And that's a way that we have parts of this play, because it was reused in the Middle Ages to be a story about Jesus. Okay, so there are some connections. So what happens? Dionysus turns the tables on Pentheus, and he says, Pentheus, the king, wouldn't you like to see what these women are doing? You think they're having orgies, and you don't like women being out by themselves, so I'll bring you out there, you can spy on them and see these orgies. And he says, okay. But Dionysus says, first you have to dress up as a woman, because only women are allowed. So it's kind of a joke that Pentheus is this male who's using power and a king and kind of foolish. So Dionysus dresses him up as a woman, leads him out to the hillside, and puts him up in a tree to watch the women's rites. Well, what did women do in rites of Dionysus? Maybe you know this story, right? Or even better if you don't. This will knock your socks off. Well, in his rites of Dionysus, the women were out there, and the animals were coming up to them because they were in harmony with nature. Of course, we know some stories like St. Francis are like that. And also milk and honey are flowing out of the ground because they command these powers of nature. And women, the Bacchae worshipping Dionysus, they would rip apart wild animals. They had this rite. They would rip apart the animal and eat the raw blood. While it's still hot, why do you eat the blood? Why is it better fresh than cooked? Because it's still alive. What's in the blood? Dionysus, the life force, the soul is in the blood. You take it in, and that's communion. You get in the strength of Dionysus. Now you say gross, but this was communion. What do we have today? Eat my body and drink my blood. You eat a god. You sacrifice the god and you eat the god. Right? So that was real. That was literal. The Eucharist only became a metaphor in the Reformation when the Protestants said, we'll take that as a metaphor. We don't want to do that anymore. Right? But that's very similar. Communion, eating the god, or whatever, like the laurel leaves of the Pythia, to take in the sacred divine within that, because nature has something divine that makes it grow. Okay? So they're doing that. That's what they really did occasionally in Greek. Not every day. But now this is a tragedy. Pentheus is watching them, and they are maddened by Dionysus. And they say, oh, there's a lion up in the tree. And they rip apart Pentheus, including his own mother. Mistaken for an animal, they rip him apart. Then they come to their senses, and they see that they have Pentheus's head, and they bring him back to town, and it's a tragedy, and they learn from their suffering, like you do in tragedy. And they learn a lesson. You cannot diss Dionysus. You cannot deny Dionysus. Dionysus did all this to show you, this is my power. You better believe. It's a miracle story. But not for Pentheus. So that was actually, and here's a scene in it from a Roman wall painting. So that's the message, accept Dionysus. This is part of life. You can't always be in the city. You can't always be under control. And then they said, well, we'll have festivals. Every year we'll have a festival of Dionysus. We'll have theater. We'll let the women do this. And that's what we do. We have Mardi Gras. We have Halloween. We act silly. We know we can go on vacation, act differently, and so forth. And that you need that to be sane. So that's how it became a symbol of the unconscious today in modern times. Where in modern times, Apollo is the rational order. Dionysus is the unconscious and everything else. Which is also part of life and nature, right? It's a life force itself coming out in these altered states. Okay, so actually, she got in a lot of different things, and what we wanted to get in, although there's so much more. So, questions? Please.
What is the source other than Virgil and Homer? Is it verbal tradition?
For what?
Verbal tradition?
The source of what? Oh, there's many sources. The Bacchae is a tragedy by Euripides. All the tragedies we have except one are about myths. They were all put on in the theater of Dionysus at a religious festival of Dionysus, and are about myths which involve gods and heroes and religious eras, earlier times.
Are there written sources?
Sure, yes. There are many, many Greek poems. written literature plus art, which can be different, because every time you tell a story it can be different. There are many versions. There's no one Bible, no one fixed version. Sure, so all ancient literature is about this. Greek and the Latins picked it up.
Pythia chose what, Apollo?
Yes.
Reasoned, and he came on the side of Dionysus.
Yeah, that's right, although he makes a complicated blending of both. The Apollonian Dionysian that we know of today, this is taught in psychology classes, as Apollonian and Dionysian. That's all from Nietzsche, who wrote The Birth of Tragedy. Nietzsche was a classics professor, and then he got a real job and became a philosopher, and he wrote The Birth of Tragedy, and which is really about the death of tragedy, by the way, and he says it's a mixture of Apollo and Dionysus. He kind of elevated Dionysus, but he ends up saying Apollo gives you the veil of illusion that's a representational act of acting, you know.
Didn't he attack Socrates and the later Greeks for being too reasonable?
Yes, that's right. He said reason killed this. He gave us this dichotomy, Apollonian and Dionysian. So I'll have students who say, I took a psychology class, and they told me there were four types of people, Apollonian, Dionysian, Promethean, and Epimethean. Do you remember Prometheus and the stupid brother who took Pandora in? Epimetheus? And they actually teach this. This is how they cannot get any further for personality types. This is one, it must be one famous book or something, because they all write about this. They've taught these mythical categories for basic personality types. That's how the myths are about people. But they're not just about psychology. Today we want to say this is all psychology, what we feel. But it's about nature. We have human nature because we're part of nature. So these are forces in nature. Love and drunkenness and sex and growth and death and everything else. It's about existence. And that's how it becomes a real religion and not just cute stories. But the stories can become comical because poets can write them up and play with it too. Okay, thanks. Next time we have Greek hero stories, okay? Thank you.